Welcome to Parents' Perspective. We'll be with you in just a minute, Mrs. Thomas. The nurse raised her head just slightly over the reception desk and nodded to 4-year-old Brendan's mom. Whimpered Brendan, moving away from the dump truck he had been playing with and clinging to his mom's leg.
I don't want a shot.
I know, sweetie, Mrs. Thomas stroked Brendan's hair. But the shot will keep you well. You don't want to be sick when Grammy and Gramps come to visit or when your birthday comes, right?
No shot! No shot!
Brendan buried his head in his mom's lap.
No, no, no!
Mrs. Thomas looked back at the nurse. Is it really worth all this? She asked. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about childhood vaccinations? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is an expert on immunizations. Dr. Melinda Wharton is the Deputy Director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Wharton has authored or co-authored more than 80 scientific journal articles, book chapters, and CDC publications. She's also the mother of 3 children, ages 14, 12, and 9. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Wharton.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
What would you say is the biggest myth about childhood vaccines?
I think the biggest myth now in this age where so many of the diseases occur at such a low frequency and parents don't experience them very frequently is that the diseases aren't out there anymore. And so it's really not very important to get vaccinated because your child can stay healthy without vaccines. The reality of it is the only disease that's been eradicated is smallpox, and we don't even vaccinate against that anymore. And all of the diseases that we vaccinate children for are still out there in the world. Some of them are still pretty common in the United States. Others are only a plane ride away. And we can protect our children from these diseases by vaccinating them. It's not a risk-free choice to choose not to vaccinate your child because you're leaving your child vulnerable to diseases that otherwise you could prevent.
Are those treatable diseases?
Medical science certainly can handle many things better than it used to. There's no doubt about that. But just because medical science is better, it doesn't mean that the diseases are without risk with modern treatment. For example, polio still paralyzes children in countries of the world where polio is spread. And we don't want to treat polio. We want to prevent it. Mm. Pertussis still kills children in the United States.
That's whooping cough,
which particularly when young children get it, they have these spells or bouts of very serious coughing. They may not be able to eat. They can't catch their breath between coughs, which we can't treat very well. And to have a child cough day after day after day, not be able to eat, we have 10 or 20 deaths every year in the United States, almost all of young infants due to pertussis in this country. So just because medical science can do many things better than it used to be able to do, it doesn't mean that prevention isn't still important. There is a measles outbreak, and most of the families are families that have taken personal belief exemptions and have not had their children vaccinated. And there's 5 or 6 cases now in these families that we know about. But there was another child who was exposed to one of these other children in a doctor's office. And this child was 10 months old, was too young to have received measles vaccine, which we don't give until children are 12 months old. This child was exposed to measles at the doctor's office. Then the family got on a plane and flew to Hawaii, where the child was diagnosed with measles. So because people had made the decision not to vaccinate their children, not only their children are at risk, but other people are too, because this 10-month-old got measles at the doctor's office and now exposed all these people on an airplane as they were flying to Hawaii. So it certainly can happen that the choices we make don't just impact us, it affects other people as well.
How do modern vaccines work?
That is a great question. Vaccines work by teaching the immune system how to respond to the particular germ that causes the disease. And it does it in a way that you don't get the disease. Of course, your immune system could learn for most of these diseases by getting the disease, but that's not the way we want to teach it, because then you get sick and something really bad could happen. So what we want to do is teach the immune system how to protect the body without getting sick. And that's the whole point of vaccines. One of the things that has happened as vaccine technologies have improved And as we have more understanding of the science around vaccines and around these different diseases, the modern vaccines that are being developed now tend to be much purer and have more targeted responses than the older vaccines we used to use. And that tends to make them cause less reactions and be better tolerated for children than some of the older vaccines were. For example, the old pertussis vaccine that we used to use when I was a kid, which was a long time ago, was the whole cell pertussis vaccine, which was consisted of killed pertussis bacteria, the bacteria that causes whooping cough. It was killed, and that's how the vaccine was made. And so children did develop protection from pertussis from this vaccine. The vaccine did work. But because it had all of this other stuff in it, everything else that was in the bacteria, which was a lot of stuff, ended up in that vaccine. And some of those other components caused fevers. They could cause very high fevers and swelling and large local reactions. And it was a vaccine which everybody recognized clearly did cause reactions. So the pertussis vaccines that we've used now for many years are what we call acellular vaccines, which just means they're purified. They only contain specific components of the organism. So you're only given what you really need to get protection, and all the other stuff isn't in the vaccine. And how vaccines have been reformulated and improved over the years is to make them purer and purer so that you only get the parts you need to be protected, and we try to leave out the parts that just give you fevers and cause problems. So vaccines now, in general, are much purer and have more targeted responses than they used to have.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on childhood vaccinations.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Melinda Wharton about childhood vaccines. Is there a danger with all the emphasis on vaccines and trying to prevent things that we're going to raise a generation of children with no natural immunity to anything?
Well, you know, I think people, in looking at this long list of diseases that we now vaccinate children for, naturally think, oh my gosh, I mean, isn't there something good that comes from stimulating the immune system? Shouldn't my child have a chance to get some of those things naturally? The problem with getting them naturally is you get sick. And sometimes children who get sick even die. They can get serious complications. So it's not like we're going to be in a germ-free world just because we're preventing, you know, 14 diseases in young children through use of vaccines. I think all of us with kids remember when our children first went off to daycare or preschool or elementary school being sick pretty much all the time there right. For that first year. And yes. We live in a world that's full of bacteria and viruses that children encounter. Their immune systems get plenty of stimulation from other things they're exposed to that give them colds or give them mild illnesses, but are not nearly as likely to make them really ill, make them seriously ill, as the diseases that we prevent with vaccines. So the immune system will still have plenty of things to do.
Normally, what vaccines do children receive and when do they receive them?
Our recommended childhood schedule has children receiving the hepatitis B vaccine at birth. And we recommend that this vaccine be given at birth because sometimes children can be infected at birth from hepatitis B if their mother's been infected. And we can help prevent that by vaccination at birth. Children who are infected with hepatitis B at birth are at high risk of developing chronic infection due to hepatitis B, cancer of the liver from that virus, or overwhelming infection. So we really don't want children to get infected at birth, and that's part of the reason we start the vaccine at that time. So children begin their hepatitis B series then, and then at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, we add vaccines that prevent rotavirus, which is a very serious cause of viral diarrhea and vomiting in young children. That's the really bad kind of gastroenteritis. that causes many hospitalizations and emergency room visits. I remember when my oldest child had what I'm certain was rotavirus when she was just under a year old. She was vomiting for days and had diarrhea for days. It's a very significant illness, even for children who end up not going to see the doctor, which my daughter didn't. But it's something certainly that as a parent you'd really like to not have your child go through. We also, in that first year of life, give the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine. This prevents diphtheria, which is a disease that we don't see much in the United States anymore, but there was a big outbreak of in the former Soviet Union during the 1990s when immunization coverage fell there.
What is diphtheria?
Diphtheria is a bacterial infection that tends to cause a very bad sore throat that actually can extend down into the lungs and cause suffocation. And it also can cause nerve damage and heart damage because the bacteria makes a toxin which can damage both the heart and the nervous system. So it's a very serious disease. It was a major cause of death at the turn of the 20th century in both the United States and England. The movie Balto, about the beginning of the Iditarod dog race in Alaska, that was when there was an outbreak of diphtheria in Nome in the 1920s. We still treat diphtheria with antitoxin antibodies to the diphtheria toxin. So there was a dog team that brought the antitoxin to Nome when there was a diphtheria outbreak there. Tetanus, of course, is everywhere. The spores are in the environment. It's not a contagious disease. You don't get it from other people. You get it from the environment. But children who aren't vaccinated are vulnerable to tetanus, and it doesn't matter how careful you are or how clean your home is or how good care you take of your child. If your child isn't vaccinated, they're vulnerable to tetanus. And the cases of tetanus we see in the United States are in people who made the decision not to vaccinate their children and left them vulnerable.
What happens when they have tetanus?
Tetanus causes very severe muscle spasms. It can be fatal. This is a disease where with good intensive care and respiratory support, it's less likely to be fatal than it used to be. But certainly it's not anything you want to experience if you can avoid it. And, of course, pertussis we already talked about, or whooping cough. We also vaccinate against Haemophilus influenza B, which is a cause of bacterial meningitis, or infection of the membranes covering the brain. And this disease has almost disappeared in the United States due to the vaccine. It's really been a big success story. Haemophilus influenza B has been particularly a problem in some populations like Native American and Alaskan Native populations. The rates have been higher than in the general population in the United States. Another cause of bacterial meningitis that we vaccinate young children for is pneumococcal meningitis, which is it's a different kind of bacteria. And this vaccine also can prevent some ear infections that are due to the pneumococcal bacteria and other serious bloodstream infections caused by this bacteria. And this has, again, resulted in very dramatic reductions in these diseases in young children, but not only in them, in other people too. It seems to have reduced the circulation of these particular types of the bacteria in the population. So older people for whom the vaccine we recommend is not as effective as we would like it to be, probably we've prevented many, many cases of pneumococcal pneumonia and other serious diseases in older people because we've been vaccinating young children with the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine. So that's really been a big success. And we also vaccinate for polio in the first year of life.
Are all of these in the first year of life?
These are all in the first year of life.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think that that's why parents, on taking their child to the doctor and being told they have to get more than a couple shots at that visit or having that be recommended, people say that seems like too much. The good news is that we do have some combination vaccines that decrease the number of injections. So these don't have to all be separate shots, and that's a good thing. Nobody likes to give a very small baby a whole lot of shots. But it's not just about needles. It's about protection. And to be able to protect your child from all these diseases by getting them their routinely recommended immunizations at 2, 4, and 6 months of age is a really good thing for parents, and it's a good thing for their children. We've also started recommending, just within the last few years, influenza vaccine for young children. And the first year children get influenza vaccine, they need to get 2 doses of the vaccine. And then after that, they can just get one dose.
Why is that?
It takes repeated exposure for the immune system to develop a protective response. We've been getting exposed to influenza viruses off and on throughout our whole lives. And so our immune systems have already learned a little bit about the influenza virus. But for young children, they haven't had those exposures. So they're not going to get protection with one dose of vaccine.
How young do children get protected against influenza?
Well, we use influenza vaccine, and we recommend it be used down to 6 months of age. The way we can protect these younger children, the children who are too young to be vaccinated, is by vaccinating the people around them. And that, in fact, is what we recommend doing. So if you've got a baby that's too young to be vaccinated, if the people who are around that child, the older children in the family, the parents, the babysitter, the grandparents. So those are the vaccines that we recommend to be given in the first year of life. And then there's other vaccines that are recommended for the second year of life.
Are there some situations where a child really shouldn't be vaccinated? And if so, how would a parent know?
Well, this is why it's important for parents to communicate with their health care provider, with the doctor or the nurse, where their child gets their shots. We don't recommend that children get vaccinated who are really sick. Now, by really sick, I'm not talking about a little bit of a fever or a little bit of a cold. But for a child who's sick with a pretty high fever or where it's not completely clear what's going on, we would recommend waiting until that child is better.
Are there any situations where a child might be allergic to some component of what's in the vaccine, and how would parents know that?
Well, you're usually not going to know about an allergy if the child has shown no evidence of having that allergy. In fact, the first evidence might be with a vaccine. Fortunately, allergic responses to vaccines, or the serious allergic reactions to vaccines, are pretty uncommon, but they can happen. The more common things that children experience in the way of adverse events following vaccination have to do with soreness and swelling and redness at the site of the vaccination and fever. And the fever is usually not high fever, and it usually can be managed with Tylenol or the other ways that we treat fever in young children. So most of the side effects from vaccines are not serious, and they're pretty easy to manage. But there can be serious side effects that occur, although the vaccines that we use now are safer than they've ever been, so these events are pretty infrequent.
I'm sure you're aware of the criticisms and the questions people have about developmental difficulties and autism possibly being connected with some kinds of vaccines. Has there been research into this?
Thank you for asking that, because I know this is something that's on a lot of people's minds now, and there certainly has been a lot of discussion about this in the press and on the web. What is the relationship between vaccines and autism? It's true, we recommend more vaccines than we used to recommend, and we recognize autism spectrum disorders more frequently than we used to recognize it. So many people have raised the question, is there a relationship between vaccines and autism? This has been looked at in many studies in different populations using different approaches and looking at different ideas about how vaccines might cause autism. And the studies don't support that vaccines cause autism. The studies that have been well done using appropriate scientific methods. This is a real issue for parents, though. Parents still have real things they're trying to deal with and real issues and real struggles on a day-to-day basis. And I think until we've got better answers for them than we now have, okay, if it's not vaccines, what is it?
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on childhood vaccinations.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Melinda Wharton about childhood vaccines.
What do you see as the future of these childhood vaccines? Is there something we can look forward to, something good we can look forward to?
One of the things that's happened with some of the newer vaccines is they're not injected. So, for example, the rotavirus vaccine is an oral vaccine. And even though your child has to get all these shots at age 2 months, one of those shots is administered as drops. It's an oral vaccine that prevents this really serious kind of diarrhea. And we now have an influenza vaccine that's a nasal spray. It's a weakened form of the virus that you give by the natural route. So you get not only immunity in your blood, but you get immunity in your nose. And that's a good place to have immunity to influenza. As vaccine research continues, scientists are looking at other ways to deliver vaccines so that maybe someday we, in fact, won't have all these shots. There's been studies looking at administering vaccines by patch. So instead of getting the Band-Aid after the shot, you could just put the Band-Aid on.
What a good idea.
So I think that we will have some new vaccine delivery technologies in the future. But in the short term, what we'll probably see are some additional choices, having some different versions of some of the vaccines we now have that may allow, for instance, new combination vaccines so that we can give some of the shots together and decrease the number of injections.
Why would you say that people think vaccines are not necessary?
When I was a child, my parents lived in terror of polio. And my husband has stories about his mother not letting him go to the swimming pool in the summer. I mean, during the 50s, that's what people were really worried about. Polio was a scourge that swept through the country every summer. At children's summer camps, I've heard stories about the ambulances coming at night to take the children away. I mean, this is something that parents today, fortunately, no longer experience. But this has been human experience up until just the last few decades that we lived with these diseases. We saw it as parents, and we were really afraid of them. My mother remembered being quarantined for diphtheria when her sister had it when she was a child. Now, my mother was really old. I mean, this was around the time of World War I. But these are not things people see anymore. And because they don't see them, I think they tend to think that, well, they're not really that bad, and medicine is so much better than it used to be, nobody would really die of that. So it would be okay if my child gets sick. The reality of it is we don't want to expose our children to risks we don't have to expose them to. To be a parent is to be scared all the time. You're always scared of something. What you're scared of kind of depends on how old your child is, but you're always scared of something. Parents used to be scared of these diseases. And now, because the diseases aren't so visible, it's harder to see them. Some parents, when they read about it, what they get concerned about are the risks. And there certainly are some risks that come with some of the vaccines. I won't say that it's risk-free. But the vaccines we have now are safer than the vaccines that we used to have. I won't say that there aren't still risks associated with vaccination. Of course there are, because no medical intervention is absolutely 100% safe all the time in everybody. But what parents need to remember is to not vaccinate their child is not a risk-free decision. They're leaving their child vulnerable to diseases that are still out there, that could still put their child in the hospital, still make their child very sick, or even, under some circumstances, result in their child dying. And these are diseases which, for the most part, we can prevent with vaccination.
Dr. Wharton, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue some of these issues further on their own?
There's a lot of information available about vaccines. And some particular sources that we would recommend are our CDC vaccine website, which is www.cdc.gov/vaccines. And there's information there on the recommended schedules, on all of the recommended vaccines, on side effects of vaccines, on what to expect when your child is vaccinated, all kinds of information. And that's where parents can get information about the schedules and what we recommend that their children receive. There are some other great resources available on the web from other organizations other than the government. And one of those is the American Academy of Pediatrics. which has information on their website at www.aap.org. Also, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has a great resource on the web for information that's specifically aimed at parents. And their website is www.chop, which is Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, chop.edu. Other organizations that have great information on the web are the Immunization Action Coalition at www.immunize.org, as well as Every Child by Two, which is www.ecbt.org.
Well, this conversation has certainly been a vaccination for all of us against misconceptions and ignorance. So, Dr. Melinda Wharton, thank you so much for being with us today to talk about childhood vaccines.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child: Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 361 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. We'd like to thank the SF Foundation for its generous funding of this particular program. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.